From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, President Obama says the US and France are united on Iran and Syria as French President François Hollande's state visit continues.
President Hollande and I agree on the need to continue enforcing existing sanctions, even as we believe that new sanctions during these negotiations would endanger the possibility of a diplomatic solution.
Also today, thousands are evacuated as severe flooding continues to blanket large parts of the UK. The anti-NSA movement, The Day We Fight Back, launches worldwide. Our correspondent on the Hill has the details, and we look at the political career of the late legendary child star, Shirley Temple Black.
Our team wound up being arrested, and the leader of our team was thrown in jail. Ambassador Shirley Temple Black got us out of jail.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Features Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. US President Barack Obama and French President François Hollande are meeting to discuss Syria at the start of the French president's visit to the US. Earlier, Syria's ally Russia promised that the chemical weapons stockpiles would be at the coast for shipment to offshore destruction by March 1st. Meanwhile, in Geneva, UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi says talks between the Assad regime and the Syrian opposition are going nowhere. In Washington, US President Barack Obama says he's talking with allies such as the French and others about all possible options on Syria policy.
The situation is fluid, and we are continuing to explore every possible avenue to solve this problem, because it's not just heartbreaking to see what's happening to the Syrian people. It's very dangerous for the region as a whole, including friends and allies partners like Lebanon or Jordan that are being adversely impacted by it.
Meanwhile, a key mandate within President Barack Obama's troubled health care law, which affects medium-sized businesses, has once again been delayed. It affects firms of 50 to 99 workers who will now avoid tax penalties until 2016. One of the most senior figures sentenced by the United Nations-backed War Crimes Tribunal for their role in the Rwandan genocide has been acquitted. William Denzelow reports from FSN's New York Bureau.
In a judgment released Tuesday, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda's decision to charge General Augustin Ndidlimana with genocide has been reversed. This comes after a judgment stated that the ex-paramilitary police chief had little command over those that carried out the killing of over 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus and opposed the massacres. Ndidlimana was a free man before the judgment, as his sentence was set at the 11 years he spent in custody, awaiting his trial, having been arrested in Belgium in the year 2000. William Denslow, New York.
Tributes have been paid to Shirley Temple, the former child star who has died in the United States at the age of 85. She first rose to prominence in the 1930s after getting her first role on the silver screen at the age of just 3. But as our US correspondent Simon Marks reports, she went on to have an illustrious second career after she retired from the cinema.
On the good ship, Lollipop.
She's best known worldwide as the child star who took audiences aboard the good ship Lollipop and put animal crackers in her soup. But Shirley Temple had a second career as a US diplomat, serving as ambassador first to Ghana, then in 1989 to Czechoslovakia, just as the Velvet Revolution against communism unfolded. She was a witness to the birth of the Czech Republic and widely commended for her role as US ambassador during a turbulent time, a woman who forsook Hollywood for the world of diplomacy, saying that she had had enough of pretend. Simon Marks, New York.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A plane has crashed in Algeria with more than 100 passengers and crew feared dead. The Algerian military transport plane crashed into mountains in the country's northeastern Touraine. So far, one survivor has been found, with women and children among the 71 bodies recovered. Search and rescue operations continue. British Prime Minister David Cameron says money is no object in the relief efforts as floods cover large parts of southern England. In an emergency press conference from Downing Street, the British leader said he'd cancelled a trip to the Middle East next week. That's to deal with the relief efforts. The wettest winter in 250 years has prompted widespread flooding in parts of the country for the past 2 months. In recent days, thousands more homes along a large stretch of the River Thames have been flooded, causing misery to residents and widespread disruption to transport services. The Prime Minister says people could rest assured the government would help them recover.
And my message to the country today is this: money is no object in this relief effort. Whatever money is needed for it will be spent. We will take whatever steps are necessary.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The French national anthem being played on the South Lawn of the White House this Tuesday morning to say bienvenue to the French President François Hollande. He arrived at the Executive Mansion for a state visit, only the fifth time so far that Mr. Obama has extended the honour to another world leader. After the ceremony, it was down to business, with the two men holding a joint press conference, during which the US leader admitted progress must be made towards peace in Syria.
The situation is fluid, and we are continuing to explore every possible avenue to solve this problem, because it's not just heartbreaking to see what's happening to the Syrian people. It's very dangerous for the region as a whole, including friends and allies partners like Lebanon or Jordan that are being adversely impacted by it.
Well, that press conference and a visit to Arlington Cemetery will be followed on Tuesday night by a lavish White House state dinner. But what made President Obama choose François Hollande for the privilege? And why now? FSN's Lorna Shaddick put those very questions to Charles Kupchan, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations here in Washington.
President Obama has not given many state visits at all. That this is the first European state visit, I think, suggests the importance of the burgeoning relationship between France and the United States. And that new focus on Paris and on the French president, I think, stems from several things. One is the weakening of the UK as America's entree to Europe. And that's partly because the UK is distancing itself from the continent. And when it comes to Iran, when it comes to the projection of power in the Middle East, in Africa, France has actually stood up to the plate more than any other European power.
And some have also said that this perhaps is being seen as a little bit of a reward for supporting President Obama on the issue of chemical weapons in Syria, and for going into Mali, something the US would like to have done but couldn't possibly have done itself.
I do think that when you say, with which European country does the United States today enjoy a significant coincidence of interest, France really is at the top of the list. And when it comes, for example, to Syria, and Obama did decide ultimately not to use military force in response to chemical weapons, it was French planes that were on the tarmac ready to go to cooperate with the United States. When it comes to the negotiations with Iran, France was actually ahead of the United States, wanted to impose more stringent conditions. It's usually the other way around. The United States is in the lead and pulling its European allies along. When it came to the projection of power in Libya, even though it was not on Hollande's watch, France and President Sarkozy were out in front. Mali, Central African Republic, the French are very engaged and making sacrifices.
And you mentioned giving President Hollande a shot in the arm. I think I'm right in saying his polling numbers are among the worst for any French president. Domestically, he's badly in need of some help. Do you think rubbing shoulders with President Obama is going to do that?
Well, Hollande is scraping the bottom of the barrel. And in that respect, coming to the United States, going to Monticello, singing the praises of the bond between the United States and France historically, getting dressed up in white tie and going to the White House. This can only help him domestically. The bottom line is that going to the White House, spending time with the American president, still has cachet around the world. Is it going to save Hollande politically? No. Will it give him a bump in the polls? I expect so.
There's been a lot of emphasis on the historic ties between the US and France. But if you go back to very, very recent history, just in the last decade, things were at an all-time low. So what's changed so quickly since the era of freedom fries?
The main thing that's changed is that the undercurrent of anti-Americanism that always shaped French foreign policy is gone. It was really started by President de Gaulle when he moved away from NATO. And ever since then, French presidents have stood up to Washington as a way of trying to demonstrate their strength. President Sarkozy, Hollande's predecessor, really put that to rest. He was pro-American. He didn't try to stand up to Washington for domestic political gain. There was some concern that when Hollande came into office, the socialists would try to revive that tradition in French foreign policy. Fortunately, it hasn't happened. And in that respect, American interests and French interests, which have always been very similar, that those interests are now at the surface, no longer troubled or obscured by this to-ing and fro-ing between the French and Americans that started in the 1960s.
Charles Kupchan, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. This is FSN Reports. Today, around the world, civil liberties and privacy advocates launched what they call the Day We Fight Back, a set of actions on and offline aimed at pushing Congress to pass bills that rein in mass government surveillance. The day falls near the two-year anniversary of the successful online protest that defeated the Stop Online Piracy Act, and near the one-year anniversary of the suicide of the man who led that historic protest, internet activist Aaron Swartz. On Capitol Hill, activists and lawmakers gathered Tuesday to honour Swartz's memory and call for reforms to programmes that monitor the communications of millions of Americans. Our correspondent on the Hill, Alice Olstein, has the story.
The groups coordinating the Day We Fight Back say they've already logged nearly 45,000 calls and over 95,000 emails to Congress, as of Tuesday afternoon, from activists around the world opposed to NSA surveillance. Nathan White with Demand Progress, one of the lead organizers of the global protest, said it's another indication of the growing opposition to the government programs that NSA contractor Edward Snowden began revealing this past summer.
And what that should tell you is that this is not an issue from the left, from the right. This is not an issue that affects one aspect of the community. This is an issue that affects everyone. This is an issue that combines business interests with constitutional interests, with civil liberties issues, with privacy rights. This is an issue that affects every single one of us.
But while programs that sweep up the so-called metadata of phone and email records may indeed affect nearly everyone in the United States, Noor Mir with the Washington Peace Center says other government programs target some communities more than others.
For me, standing here as a person of color with family and loved ones in Pakistan, a country labeled as the most dangerous country in the world, I fear that every personal exchange and intimate moment, from the phone call I made this morning to the email I'll send after this, will one day or could be used against me. The criminal act of surveillance has been committed against people of color in this country for decades. What have we done except carry the burden of being born the way we were and looking the way we do?
Mir referenced the monitoring of Dr. Martin Luther King and other black activists in the 1960s under COINTELPRO and the mass spying on American Muslim communities post 9/11.
Now this kind of abuse is being repeated, but on a global scale.
That's New Jersey Democrat Rush Holt, the former chair of the House Select Intelligence Oversight Panel. He is also the author of the Surveillance State Repeal Act, which would completely scrap from U.S. law the two main legal pillars of government spying, the Patriot Act and the FISA Amendments Act.
My bill would also prohibit the government from forcing American technology companies to compromise their software and hardware by building in backdoors that the NSA could use to, well, spy on us. And it would create in the law for the first time protections for whistleblowers in the national security sphere.
The Surveillance State Repeal Act currently has few supporters and only a slim chance in a deeply divided Congress. But a more modest proposal, called the USA Freedom Act, is gaining traction in the House and Senate, and with enough pressure from activists, could receive a vote this year. That bill would end the bulk collection of Americans' phone records, among other reforms. Constitutional lawyer Shahid Buttar with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee said Tuesday that while he and others support both of these proposals to rein in NSA spying, more transparency is needed.
We have not seen all of the Snowden revelations, nor have the intelligence agencies responded to them by becoming any more forthcoming about their crimes en masse upon the American people. Which is to say, Congress continues to legislate in the dark. We don't yet know how vast is the iceberg. We remain debating an increasing volume of those tips of the iceberg breaking through the wall of secrecy that has protected this corrupt enterprise of mass warrantless surveillance over the last decade.
Buttar said advocates can't know what reforms to push for until they know the full extent of what the government is up to. They are currently fighting in Congress and in federal courts for access to that information. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Things could get worse before they get better. The stark warning from British Prime Minister David Cameron as the country's flood crisis deepens. Weather, described as the most exceptional period of rainfall to hit England and Wales in nearly 250 years, has already left 5,000 properties flooded. Troops have now been deployed to help with the flood relief efforts as thousands of homes along the River Thames were evacuated, with more severe weather expected. FSN's correspondent Natalie Feary spoke to me from one of the affected flood zones just outside the capital.
Well, I'm in a Bourne End in Buckinghamshire, about 30 miles outside of London, and it's one of the areas where there's 14 severe flood warnings along the River Thames. This means that there is a risk threat to life. The houses we've been along have seen about 2 metres of water flooding. Just close by is the village of Cookham, which has been completely cut off because the roads are flooding, so you can't get into or out of Cookham, and one of the houses we were in today. Luckily, they were built pretty modern houses that are raised up, so they have some grills where water flows underneath their house. But their garage, they've had to put sandbags up around their garage and around their homes because the water level does continue to rise. Looking out from the houses where I'm at, across where the river should be, you can just see water across to pretty far away across where normally would be fields and grazing land, and all that is completely inundated where the River Thames has flown over its barriers.
And what sort of level of destruction has this weather brought with it?
Well, you know, we have seen quite a lot of disruption to commuters, to rail lines, and some parts of the country we've actually seen rail lines flooded over and destroyed, so trains aren't able to pass to certain parts in the south of England, and of course lots of roads also affected. Just to give you an idea about the train lines, Network Rail, which runs the train, you know, the train tracks, says that there are around 400 to 500 railway sites that are a concern, and normally at this time of the year there'd be around 12 sites of concern. So that gives an idea of just the level of disruption that is really unprecedented in terms of the amount of rain, the amount of flooding, and it's more than twice the average rainfall for this time of year. So finding it pretty hard to cope, really struggling to deal with what's unprecedented weather conditions.
And I think to give people an idea of the scope here, we're talking about more than 5,000 properties have been flooded altogether over the last 2 months. There are currently 14 severe flood warnings in place. We're talking about a large expanse of area here across counties. Can you tell us what has the government response been to the crisis?
Well, you know, the government is, of course, saying that they're doing what they can. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, saying it is a huge challenge, but saying that the government will spend the money necessary. They'll use all the necessary resources, and there are 1,600 troops available to help people. Some have been deployed already to rescue people from their homes, to try and bring them to safety, to try and ensure that everybody is as safe as possible. Now, there has been some political fallout from this between the Environment Agency and ministers, a bit of a blame game going on, but David Cameron, the Prime Minister, saying that what is important at the moment is to try and deal with the situation, which, may I add, could continue for several months because the groundwaters are so high. And he says that, laying blame or looking at where fault is should be left aside for the moment.
FSN's Natalie Feary. The number of families affected by autism is growing. The US Centers for Disease Control estimate that 1 in 88 American children have been diagnosed with autism or another form of autistic spectrum disorder, a number that nearly doubled between 2000 and 2008, and one that scientists haven't yet been able to explain. FSN's Denver correspondent Mary McCarthy met with Temple Grandin, who is considered one of the world's leading experts on autism. Not just because she has written some of the most informative books about the condition, but because she herself is autistic. They discussed her latest book, The Autistic Mind, Thinking Across the Spectrum.
Temple Grandin lives in a modest townhome in Fort Collins, Colorado, that's crowded with her collection of animal trinkets.
These are some of the little cool things people have given me, little animal things.
But she spends much of her time traveling the world as an advocate for autistics.
I would estimate that many of the people that work in the tech industry, doing computer programming, developing all kinds of electronics, people have worked on a space program and other things, have got a little bit of that autistic trait. You take out some social genes, then you get genes for doing fun stuff, like doing a trip to the moon or doing the Mars rover or developing something like an iPhone. In fact, I find a lot of technical people that are probably on the spectrum avoid the labels. Just today, I was talking to a manager of a tech company, and they said, oh, we know that a lot of our people that work here are a little bit on the spectrum. We just don't talk about it.
In her latest book, The Autistic Brain, Grandin highlights the contributions that autistics have made to society.
We've got to build on strengths. You know, there's a lot of emphasis right now with kids that got to know mathematics, but we also need to have the art mind, the visual thinking mind like me. Remember, Steve Jobs was an artist. So when you use your smartphone, remember an artist made that interface. Then the engineers had to make the insides work. That's where you need to have the two kinds of minds working together. Maybe some of the technological breakthroughs we made many, 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 many thousands of years ago, like making certain kinds of stone tools and things, were done by somebody on the autism spectrum. Because people on the autism spectrum are into details. The normal mind tends to overgeneralize, but the autistic mind is all about the details.
Temple Grandin's autism advocacy and research is just a part of her work. She's also a renowned professor of animal science who has designed livestock handling facilities that are used around the world. Grandin credits her mother with pushing her to develop her talents and overcome the severe social awkwardness that affects autistics.
Mother was instrumental in always pushing me. She had a really good idea just how much to stretch me. Because to get some of these kids to advance, you got to push them just outside their comfort zone. But remember, no surprises. Surprises scare. And when I was a teenager and I had the opportunity to go out to my aunt's ranch, I was afraid to go. And mother says, well, you have a choice. You can go for 1 or 2 weeks or you can go all summer. But not going, that was not going to be one of the choices.
Grandin's mother was ahead of her time, coming up with her own methods of dealing with her daughter's developmental challenges. Today, most parents of autistic children are taught to do exactly what her mother did, intervene early with specific therapies.
If you have a 3-year-old child that's nonverbal, the worst thing you can do is nothing. You've got to work with that child, teaching him words, teaching him how to take turns. You must not let them just sit in a corner rocking. And then you get the mild forms of autism where there is no speech delay. This is your socially awkward kid that might be really good at math or something like that, that he needs to be moved ahead in math. Don't hold him back.
New scanning technology shows that autistic brains are wired very differently from what Grandin calls normal or neurotypical brains.
It was very exciting to get to use this new technology, high-definition diffusion tensor imaging, that can actually track individual fiber track. And I found I had a definitely abnormal circuit for speech output. I had trouble getting my speech out. But that circuit then branched all over the whole brain, which ended up giving me a visually indexed search engine.
For now, most autistics are diagnosed by physicians, psychologists, and/or psychiatrists. But Temple Grandin hopes that the growing use of brain scans will lead to earlier, more accurate, and specific diagnoses for the next generation. In Fort Collins, Colorado, I'm Mary McCarthy.
Finally, tonight.
On the good ship, Lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play. On the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay.
The legendary former child star Shirley Temple Black has died late Monday at the age of 85. She shot to Hollywood fame as a child actress in the 1930s, but retired from filmmaking at just 22. Turning her back on acting, she moved into politics and worked in several diplomatic roles, serving under four US presidents. For a look at her political career, I spoke to Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, president of the non-profit organization Respectability USA.
She was a very important player in a transformational era. She was the U.S. ambassador to what was then Czechoslovakia when it was communist, and it was really part of the Iron Curtain under the thumb of the Soviet Union. In 1989 and 1990, she really helped shepherd it to democracy, to freedom. And now the country is now two countries, and it's a completely different place, and part of that is because of her work.
Her diplomatic career, I mean, it spanned presidents, didn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, she came in under Reagan. She worked under President Bush. She had first been cited by Henry Kissinger, who overheard her speaking at a party and recognized the great intellect and real inquisitive nature that she had. And they made her an ambassador. And back then, and you know, when she first became an ambassador, and she was also an ambassador in Africa, there were very few women ambassadors. And many of the ambassadors, you know, were very close ties to political leaders. So the idea of bringing in a woman, bringing in someone from Hollywood. Reagan was from himself from Hollywood, so he understood it could happen. But it was quite transformative in terms of thinking for a lot of people.
And she made as much of an impression as a politician as she did as a child star. And famously, the words of Franklin D. Roosevelt, "As long as our country has Shirley Temple, we will be all right."
Well, indeed, and she did this in big ways and small. I'll give you an example. I was working on campaign training seminars behind the Iron Curtain. We had a group of 25 American political consultants who were trying to help the nascent Democratic activists learn how to win the nuts and bolts of how to win campaigns, because ultimately it was up to the voters as to whether they were going to have communism or they were going to have democracy. Our team wound up being arrested, and the leader of our team was thrown in jail. Ambassador Shirley Temple Black got us out of jail, took care of the situation, ensured that there was a peaceful election and that Václav Havel could go on to be president of Czechoslovakia. And of course, Václav Havel is one of the greatest leaders of this century.
Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme. Email us at reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And you can follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Wednesday, the story of the 5-foot sapling offshoot taken from the towering horse chestnut tree that Anne Frank watched from her annex window. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a good evening. Goodbye.